This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Welcome. This is Budgie, and I'm about to introduce you to a Curious Creatures special edition in which we feature an excerpt from the audiobook edition of Goth. That's Lowell Tollers, my partner in crime here. The book is now available in the USA and the UK. So order your copy now and enjoy the excerpt. Thank you.
August the 16th, 1977. Nighttime. I'm in a darkened bedroom in my hometown of Crawley, listening to the radio in the late-night gloom with a girl called the Raven. She has long, straight black hair and all black clothes. I'm 18 years old. The Raven turns the radio's tuning knob, trying to find something in the airless room to listen to. A crackle of static and a breathless voice eerily intones, "The King is dead. Elvis Presley, the King of Rock and Roll, died tonight in Memphis, Tennessee." To us, Memphis might as well have been the moon. It was that far from our experience of growing up in the ever-present doom of Thatcher's post-war Britain. We knew Elvis's death meant something, but what? The changing of the guard? A way forward? Elvis's journey may have come to an end, but mine was just beginning. Together with my friends Robert Smith and Michael Dempsey, we started on the path to recording The Cure's first album, Three Imaginary Boys. The songs were sparse and angular, somewhere between punk and pop, but the title track provided an indication of where the band was headed. Stark lyrics of longing and shadow came from a dream I had that haunted me for days. Robert perfectly melded the words with his guitar and melancholy vocals suspended on the minimalist framework of my Spartan drums and Michael's melodic pulse. I think we knew it was the right way for us, even before we really understood it. That year, among the books I read were Camus' The Stranger, Plath's The Bell Jar, and Sartre's Nausea. They all spoke to something darker within me, but also something more beautiful, and it inspired my playing. All of us channeled the pensive yearning of our souls into the music we were making that summer of 77, and discovered the blueprint for The Cure's oeuvre. We had seen the disease. The cure was inevitable.
Like X-Ray Spec, they didn't have a lot of money behind them in terms of their record deals and things like that. So they had to just do a lot of stuff themselves. So it became really, really super creative process of making your own clothes, making your own posters. Like, and my mum did all of the posters. She did the album art. She did made her own clothes, jewelry, the whole thing. She was styling the band, and that was just out of necessity.
Hi, this is Lowell Tollhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with the slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map. Your mum's, the lyrics she was singing, the words she was writing, are very in line with the type of things that that Viv Albertine was writing about with the Slits. It was very domestic. It was urban. It was a woman's experience or a young girl's experience. Susie, similar. She was writing about, you know, suburban relapse and, you know, Palm Olive is writing adventures close to home. These were, you know, it was things that guys were not writing about. You know, men in bands were not writing about, you know, the shifting of neck curtains and apart from the Stones and mention of Mother's Little Helper, you know.
I think the thing that was definitely started in punk was like, you know, it was a feminism that was going to come out. Nobody was going to be able to stop that. And it was a beautiful thing to see because, like, you know, I was thinking about it before then in the 70s, a lot of lyrics for rock bands were like mustachioed, misogynistic guys, and it didn't really, there was no talk about feelings or how things affected you. It was just, it was very sort of obvious stuff. And your mother's stuff was much more introspective. And, you know, it was something that growing up at that time, I could relate to more because it was more how I felt,
yeah,
you know, as well. So it was like through her becoming, you know, this champion of you know, women and difference, she made a difference. And that's really, to me, what was the most important thing about her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, how do you feel? Because it's like, you know, it's your mum, so it's always, there's always something different, you know.
Yeah, I agree because, you know, the first sort of punk that I heard was my mum's music. And I listened to Gem for Adolescence when I was about 15. I think I sort of listened through, you know, fully listened to the album properly all the way through. And I was really, really impressed, you know, objectively impressed.
Yeah.
With specifically with the lyrics, like the music, you know, I was not really into guitar music at all at that time. I was, you know, like into more electronic music, let's say.
Right.
So I was not really paying too much attention to the music, but I was really, really captivated by the lyrics. And I think it's because they're quite timeless lyrics. You know, they will speak to each generation, really.
Sure.
Yeah. And they kind of just have more and more relevance as the years go by, you know. And so that's, I think,
absolutely,
what's quite remarkable. I still think that today, because even songs like Germ for Adolescence, let's say, so when she wrote it, you know, I think a lot of people would have thought, oh, they're quite bizarre lyrics. You know, what's that about? It's like kind of about, you think of someone with OCD. And again, like people weren't really talking about OCD in the late 70s, I think.
No, not at all.
And,
no. Right.
And, but then, you know, 2019, 2020, we have this COVID pandemic. And then you're like, oh, my God, the lyrics are so... Oh, so prescient, you know. It's like, yeah, you may get to touch her if your gloves are sterilized.
Yeah.
You know, rinse your mouth with Listerine, blow disinfectant in her eyes. Like, you know, you could even see that as that song was written for the COVID age, because it's kind of like a love song in a sanitized world where everyone's afraid to touch each other, you know. So it's quite incredible in that sense, the lyrics.
She'd come a long way from A Bondage Up Yours musically to Gem for Your Adolescence. The melody of Gem for Your Adolescence is it touched me. I was like last night remembering, and it's just a beautiful, as you say, like a love song. The words taken a different meaning, but it's the melody and the almost like a lament. It's a very moving song. It is a paean to, you know, people without a voice, whatever it seems. I was going to ask you, it struck me also that X-Ray Specs were one of the first of the bands, the early, if you like, unquote, punk bands that went to America. Is that right?
That's right.
How was that experience?
You know, we talk about that quite a lot in the film, the New York chapter. So it's kind of a chapter of the film, and it was definitely a really important chapter in X-Ray Spec's sort of short history when they were together. Also, it was a really formative experience for my mom. So they were invited by the owner, manager of CBGB's.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on the Bowery. And it was, you know, it was kind of the epicenter of punk in the US at that time. And so they were invited, and there were very few UK bands at that time who had played CBGBs. I believe it was just my mum's band, and maybe the Damned had played at that time. I don't even think the Pistols had played.
Yeah,
I might be wrong, but I think it was they were one of the first UK punk bands to go at that time, and they had a residency, so it was playing twice a night for.
That's right. Yeah.
I believe it was a month, maybe it's between 2 weeks and a month, and
wow.
It was very intense. Yes.
That is intense.
I mean, it was kind of like, you know, it was a peak and it was a big low for my mom in terms of her mental health and the impact that had, because New York was just like way more intense than London in terms of the drug scene, in terms of the punk scene itself. So, if we thought the crowd at Eric's were badly behaved, you know, CBGB's was like probably a million times worse. Because, you know, we had some audio from an X-Ray Specs gig at CBGB's, and, you know, people in the crowd, there's a guy and he's like, "Who the fuck are you?" You know, it's like total disdain and that kind of bored angst. You know, it was quite heavy. I think the whole experience.
I asked because I just remember we also had a similar thing. The Banshees got there way much later because of the circumstances. They didn't get the band together for, like, it was 82 when we went over, so 81. But we were doing two shows a day at the Whiskey in California, in Los Angeles, and it was mind twisting. You know, I think all of us at some point we just broke down in tears because we were exhausted, emotionally drained, physically drained because of the heat and the intensity of the gigs. And we'd never experienced anything like it. I think the Clash went over, and it's probably what made them, where they did a residency in New York, and it was huge.
26 days in bonds. I remember the first time we went to the Secure. It was probably 1980, late 79, 80. And we went to New York and we played Hurrahs, which was like this big disco.
Mm.
And, you know, Simon remembers it because, like, people were going, you know, some people liked us. And then there were some people that were going, "Hey, piss on Portobello." And we were like, "What does that even mean? You know, what does that even mean?" But they were just thinking, well, that's what you say if you're punk, you know?
Yeah. So.
But generally it was good. And then we got to LA and we played the Whiskey, and it was great. I mean, it was like, you know, by that time sort of attitudes and everything had like coalesced. You know, there was a bit more communication about what's going on, and it was much better. But it's yeah, it was always weird at the beginning. I can't imagine what it'd be like to play CBGBs, because that was a, you know, very intense environment.
Absolutely hardcore.
Hardcore, I believe. God, I was going to say, there's a great quote on the, is it on the trailer for your film? Is it where the voiceover says, it wasn't that polystyrene was, had to catch up with the world. It was, we're waiting for the world to catch up with polystyrene. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. There are so many great quotes.
I have a good one. I always remember seeing X-ray specs, and I thought, how? He's got the biggest drum kit I've ever seen. He had a huge drum kit.
BP was the drummer, Big Paul. And, it was an impressive kit.
Yes.
I think the drums really, you know, obviously the sax is a standout with X-ray specs, but for me, the drums really made the sound to a large extent.
Oh, okay, Celeste, we love you even more now. Now you said that.
Yes, you see, Lol and I would have to agree with you completely 100% and say that probably the drums were key to the sound and the success.
Yeah.
Apart from, you know, present company accepted.
Yeah, we agree with James Brown. All music is drums. Right, so there you go.
All musicians are drummers.
And all musicians are drummers, right.
My mum was very, very impressed with BP's drumming, because she was all, you know, to find a really good drummer that was, because her whole thing was being tight. You know, she wanted the band to be really tight, because I think there were so many bands, you know, that had come up through the Roxy, like they had, that couldn't really play that well, let's face it. And my mum was always insecure about that, you know, that they were not sounding, you know, like a professional band. And so she was always on it, you know, on the drums, especially because that's, as she saw it, that's how, you know, that was kind of key for the band to sound really, really tight and also high energy, because that's what she always said, you know, that we're a high energy rock and roll band. That's how she described them.
Did your mum get on the kit and like this, do it like this?
Yes, well, my mum would, you know, when she was writing, she couldn't write music, for example, so she would sing, you know, the bass lines, she would sing the chords, you know, and she would be like, yeah, like kind of giving instructions for all the instruments, actually. She was definitely like, you know, a producer as well. She had that mentality, kind of a producer mentality, definitely, when it came to music making.
It's interesting. I noticed something last night. I think it was there in O Bondage, and it was there later in, I can't remember which song it was, but there was like, she had a way of writing and adding two beats. There was always a half bar somehow, and it was a really unusual kind of structure. And it was probably never, I don't know, maybe it was, but it seemed to be one of those things that the band had to understand, especially the drummer. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. It was like that kind of thing. And it's the way the lyrics went, and the song followed the structure of the lyrics as it should. But it was a way that she phrased things. It's like a rhythm that was going on. It
definitely, that's she was playing a lot with, I think there were lots of other punk bands who did the same, was this 1950s influence on the song structure and the, you know, the 1950s style pop song. So I think you get, like, so there's a song on the album called I Can't Do Anything. And that is, you know, like, and the Freddy tried to strangle me with mine. Like, the rhythm of that is, you know, it's a 1950s pop song. She was really influenced by Chuck Berry.
It's right. You got those the doo-wop bands, and even the old blues guys as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were just kind of like, there was no such thing as like loads of four bar phrases in a row. They just kind of changed when they felt like it, and it was usually to do with the feel.
Yeah,
I like all this talk. It validates a lot for me, where you say there was, you know, as a drummer, I would spend a long time before I felt I was a musician. And yet I had opinions about the music all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was playing, as I say, with the Slits and the first album, the first track on the album, it starts in 5-4 and goes into 4-4 and comes back into 5-4. And we never talked about it. Nobody ever discussed it. So it's just one of those things. But it can seem really smart and clever. Well, it was. But it was so smart and clever because we never even mentioned it.
Well, there you go. Pure genius.
And I think there's a lot misunderstood, you know, from the outside looking in. You see the way people cope with, you know, oh, what's the fun element? You know, what really was your mum's passion? You know, the dressing up and the design of everything and an image of something she was creating. But also, it came out in music and lyric and poetry. You know, it's an interesting... It's more complete art in a way than a mere single item, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's what was unique probably about punk, was that, in the sense that, you know, you'd had bands before that had experimented with fashion and art, of course, but I think because a lot of these young punk bands, like X-Ray Spec, they didn't have a lot of money behind them in terms of their record deals and things like that. So they had to just do a lot of stuff themselves. So it became really, really super creative process of making your own clothes, making your own posters. Like, and my mum did all of the posters. She did the album art. She did, made her own clothes, jewelry, the whole thing. She was styling the band. Mm-hmm. And that was just out of necessity. But, you know, I think that is kind of what elevated punk just beyond what it kind of could have been on the surface. You know, yeah. I think there were elements of it that people like my grandmother just thought was silly. But then, you know, in fact, when you kind of really look at what they were doing, it was something much, much more, I think, yeah, you've got to recognise the artistry, basically, of it, beyond the, you know, the high energy rock and roll, as one right. would say.
Right. It was a true revolution in the end.
Celeste, is your grandmother still around?
No, not my mum's mum. She passed away about 8 years ago now. So just before I started making the film, she was a great lady. She was born in 1927, so very different generation.
What did she think of everything her daughter was doing?
She was obviously so proud of my mum. My mum was the eldest child. And my nan had, you know, my mum was very smart and she was a great reader when she was a child. So my grandmother kind of had ambitions that my mum would have gone to university and would have a career like medicine or something. I think my nan wanted my mum to be a doctor. So I guess she was, you know, not too impressed in the beginning that my mum was had chosen this kind of very unstable career choice, you know, being a musician.
Yes, vouch for the instability.
Yes, my nan couldn't relate to punk whatsoever, just in terms of, you know, definitely wasn't her cup of tea. But
no, dear, no, not like that.
I mean, there's one story I tell you that my nan told me, because I grew up with my nan looked after me for most of my childhood, because, you know, my mom struggled with mental illness. So My nan was like my second mum. Yeah, my nan was quite proper, you know, like she was a secretary. And so she definitely...
Your nan didn't want to go out with you because you were always wearing different coloured socks,
well,
right?
My mum, she didn't want to go out with my mum because in the punk days, my mum would be wearing like, you know, one pink and one green sock. So my nan didn't want to go on the street with my mum.
Yes, what would the neighbours say? One green sock or one pink sock? Yeah.
Can I ask one more question before we go? When I know you went through, of course, the archive, your mum's archive of writing and paintings and artwork and clothing. What was the, was there a moment when you if you like, you took a breath and went, oh my goodness, look at that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it was when I first started to start organizing it, because, and I hadn't had time to really kind of process what was there and kind of, yeah, like organize it all. So just when I started to actually sit down and do it, it was, yeah, I was so many moments. I was, you know, I studied history and, you know, like having these basically pieces of history in my hands, you know, it's like definitely like...
Time capsule.
Time, exactly, was just amazing. And I just learned so much. There was so much I didn't know that I learned just through the archive, you know. There was so much in there, just in terms of, yeah, like lyrics that had never been published, poems, little short stories, and then all the newspaper clippings and interviews and then the artwork. But in terms of the story, it was all the mainly the written pieces, you know, of text. That was just like very, very rich.
Special moments, really special moments.
Very much so, yeah.
It's a lovely sort of way to close, I think. A nice kind of image. Opening a box like a light comes on if it was in a film.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking me down memory lane. You certainly put me back in Erich Club in Liverpool where it all began for me. And just for saying, just for being so... easy to talk to. It's nice. We feel like we're sharing very much some personal moments with you.
Thank you both, and it was really great.
It's been lovely.
And if anybody knows where BP's drum kit is, just send the coordinates, please.
I'll ask BP. We're in touch. So.
Do. Bye for now. Bye.
Bye for now. Take care. Bye.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jack Knife Lee.
Assistant editor, Ben Miller. Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.